Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 11:41 a.m. That's Pacific Summer Time. Today is September 27th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term video and audio for the various different asset classes. And I thought I would kick off this week with something I think is going to have a great deal of impact on just about everything over the course of the next couple of decades. It is the success that a small team of researchers have had at the University of Maryland in creating an algorithm that can predict the future. And it's not simply about predicting the future as in that the sun rose today, it'll rise again tomorrow, but rather from looking at highly chaotic pieces of data and then predicting the way in which they will propagate in future. This kind of calculation is completely beyond the ability of humanity to do on its own. It represents a step change in the ability of humanity to come up with solutions to previously intractable problems. This is something that is going to literally change the way we live our lives and approach questions of scientific or financial or endeavor beyond comparison with anything we've done before. This example from these charts here is incredibly compelling. They're taking the Kuramoto-Sivan-Shinsky equation. And what that does is it tries to look at how a flame runs and the path of fire, which is something that has puzzled people for decades. And by observing a small number of instances, then the machine learning algorithm has been able to predict up to in time units of Lyapunov time. Now, this is Lyapunov time is the measure of the expansion of the universe, or something to that effect. In other words, we're talking about not even thinking about instances or fractions of a second, but that it has got an extremely high ability to predict the future. Well, when we start to then think about incredibly complex questions, like, for example, how is the plasma inside a fusion reactor going to propagate? One of the biggest problems they have is not so much in creating the plasma or even containing the plasma. It's predicting that plasma, just like in the sun, has solar flares. So there are periods of time when it is going to spit out a solar flare inside the diffusion reaction, and because of that flare it'll touch the outside or it will damage the containment field and then shut down the experiment. And just like solar flares, these are chaotic events. They're impossible to predict with current technology, and now that is changing. Now, when we start to think about simpler things, like the interaction of drugs, the way that we come up with new interactions between organic material and the environment, how we can predict things like the weather, what is often deemed to be a chaotic event is increasingly going to be submitted to algorithms that can make sense of them. Now, this is something that is going to literally represent an exponential jump in the pace of technological innovation. It is something that is going to create the kind of step change in productivity growth that people have really given up hope on. The number of people I've met over the last few years that have concluded that the best of innovation has already occurred is rather large. But this kind of innovation is something that is going to translate into a whole realm of additional scientific inquiry, which will translate also into commercial success for a large number of businesses. Well, that was simply one thing that happened this week. The other thing that happened this week was that Google came out and said that they've achieved quantum supremacy. Now, quantum supremacy is a bit of an amorphous term. What they basically said was that they picked a calculation that would take approximately 10,000 years to do on the world's fastest supercomputer, and their quantum machine did it in 3.3 minutes and 20 seconds. So that was evidence that it is now possible with a quantum computer to perform calculations that would take a normal supercomputer an incredibly long period of time to perform. Now, one of the reasons for that is because there are certain mathematical formulas that simply do not submit readily to an on-off switch calculation. For example, that there is a mathematical problem where it has been extraordinarily difficult to prove that every number is the sum of two squares. And that's something that has been going on for decades, and it was really only solved quite recently. So these are the kinds of permutations that would require millions of on-off, on-off, on-off switch digital ways of thinking about a problem, but can be much faster, or it can be addressed in a much quicker manner with quantum computing, because they're not going with an on-off switch, but rather they're using quanta, which basically means it's essentially multiple possible worlds theory, that there is an infinity of possibilities between the one and the zero. So therefore, instead of simply having an on and an off switch, a one and a zero, there is an infinity of potential between those two numbers. And therefore, when we talk about qubits, this calculation was done on a computer with 53 qubits. This is something that is going to represent again, another step change in terms of the kinds of questions that can be addressed. This is perhaps the most important point. It is not that we're simply going to have quantum computers sitting on our desks. They are, or at least that is certainly not the way that it is currently envisaged. But what they will be able to do is perform the kinds of calculations that normal computers are unsuited to. And we have not had machines previously that were capable of addressing that particular need. So this is another really quite incredible advance. Google was the one that made the announcement. The draft of their paper was published briefly on NASA's website, and it was taken down after a couple of hours. So they are obviously preparing to have that claim peer reviewed before they make it public. But we also have to remember that it was earlier this year that the head of quantum computing at Google was quoted as saying that their pace of innovation is occurring at an exponential rate. What that suggests is that it is moving at an exponentially quicker pace than Moore's law. Moore's law prevailed all the way through from the late 1950s through to approximately 2012. As silicon chips approached the physical limits of an atom for two atoms of silicon, then it becomes exponentially more difficult to create smaller and smaller transistors. Therefore, we've seen that we've seen layering of chips. We've seen the pace of innovation slowing down. That has created a race to create the next thing. Quantum computing is one of those things. When we start to then think about the pace of innovation in the genetics sector, well, the cost of the first genetic sequencing cost billions. It's currently down to about $500. Within the next few years, it'll probably be $100. That was one of the first examples of a trend that could accelerate faster than Moore's law. And now we have the exponential growth of quantum computing. This is an additional example of something that can accelerate even faster than the pace of innovation that we get in the genetic sequencing sector. If we think about the stocks, Google has a 53-bit qubit, excuse me, a quantum computer. They don't generate any income from that right now. They're also one of the leaders in terms of autonomous vehicles, and they're not generating any income from that now either. And what that really suggests is that these, excuse me, these areas of scientific endeavor are just not in the price at all. IBM is another company with a 53-qubit quantum computer. The share has been trending downwards since 2013, but it does have the potential to at least do better than it has been doing. One of the biggest challenges the company has is trying to erode the vast number of employees that it has at 350,000 employees. That is a rather large number for a company that no longer wants to manufacture and is going into services. That is one of the primary reasons why the share price has been rather moribund, despite the fact that they've been buying back shares hand over fist for decades. Illumina is the primary producer of genetic sequencing tools, and it has certainly lost upward momentum over the course of the last year. That was an enormous downward key reversal that we saw in the middle of this year. It also follows the large downward dynamic that we saw from the peak in October of 2018. We had an upside key reversal 2 weeks ago. So then when we start to look at this environment, it's quite clear that the lows put in 3 weeks ago absolutely need to hold if support building is to be given the benefit of the doubt. One of the biggest problems that the healthcare sector is facing right now is not the pace of technological innovation. In fact, the pace of technological innovation is clearly ramping higher. Instead, it is the much bigger question about how are the kinds of treatments that are being developed going to be paid for? And it is the political risk that is weighing on this sector. The NASDAQ Biotechnology Index has got a clear rounding characteristic. And it is, I think, an exaggeration to say that it is a head and shoulders, because it does look like there are two shoulders on each side of the head. It might be more of an orangutan than a head and shoulders, but the downward dynamic that we've seen this week, the fact that there is this rounding characteristic, this is not positive. It really does suggest that there is the potential for a surprise on the downside from the biotechnology sector. One of the challenges that these companies have is that the innovation has been really rather expensive, and that isn't because CRISPR or genetic editing or genetic sequencing has been increasing, but rather that it just takes money and time to try and get a drug through the permitting process. And it tends to be enormously capital intensive. Well, therefore, they have tried to justify the expenses involved by pricing their products at rather extraordinary levels. Because what they're effectively doing is putting a price on life. When we look at, for example, a company like Spark Therapeutics, I went to see their, or I saw their CEO presenting at the MIT, what is it, Technology Review Conference a few years ago. She was a very sober lady and certainly did not make light of the challenges that there are in trying to get something to market. The share is currently under bid. There is the clear potential it is in fact going to be taken over. But the larger point is that there is also a problem with the business model, because it doesn't matter what you charge, if you are selling a genetic solution and you only need it once, then as soon as you've served a customer, then you need to go off and find another one. You're never going to be able to sell to that customer again. And that represents a challenge, because when we think about stranded or rare diseases, which are the ones that are certainly being targeted at present, then the cost per dose has to be extraordinarily high. And that is creating a real problem in terms of the political blowback, and particularly against a background where we have an increasingly large number of people hitting retirement age, becoming eligible for free healthcare, or in Europe already eligible for free healthcare, but they're not having these kinds of treatments made available to them because of the cost. But of course, the much longer term point is that this concentration on stranded drugs and stranded candidates is really just a proof of concept exercise. It's inordinately expensive. But the much bigger point is that genetic solutions can be deployed for chronic diseases. And that is something that is in the future of the genetic sector. I suspect, however, that we are probably going to go through a bear market in the sector before that, in fact, does start to come to market. The real commercial opportunity resides in the treatment of chronic conditions like diabetes from a cure perspective rather than a treatment perspective, or from arthritis, for which there is currently no real treatment that is anything other than treating the symptoms. What I have found interesting, though, is that I've met a few people over the course of the last week who swear by using cannabinoid oil to rub into their arthritis and having it being the most effective treatment they've ever had. And that's from buying it over the counter in areas where cannabis has been legally, is now free for recreational and legal purchase. Nevertheless, we have seen an incredible advance in the price of a significant number of the, particularly the Canadian cannabis companies. Canopy Growth Corp is now half of, well, less than half of its peak value. It needs to find support here around the $30 area. If we look at another one of the larger producers, Aurora Cannabis, then it is also right in the region of its of the lower side of its range. Part of the reason why they've been pulling back is because of overcapacity, and there was a very clear ambition by a number of these companies to build up market share. But then, of course, we have the fact that we've had a very significant pullback in Imperial Brands because of its investment in Juul, which is the vaping company, and one of the reasons why people are dropping dead left and right from using those vaping pens is because of contaminated cannabis capsules that they've been using. This is almost an example of rather than the no news story that dog bites man, this is more like man bites dog. Everybody anticipates that smoking cigarettes will eventually kill you, but they don't anticipate that it will happen overnight. And that has resulted in rather extreme selling pressure coming through in here. The pace of technological innovation is accelerating, and the commercialization of the kinds of treatments and solutions that are being developed is going to change the world. That's one of the most important things to remember about major bull markets. There are all sorts of promises made in a major bull market and in a bubbly environment, and they are nearly almost always true. When we go back and think about the internet bubble, then there were incredible stories being propagated about the wondrous market opportunity represented by the internet, and all of it came true. That did not stop the market going up a lot and subsequently coming down a lot. Google didn't even IPO until 2003 or 4, if my memory serves me correctly. Amazon was a bookseller in the late 1990s. Now today it sells absolutely everything. One of the most important points is that Amazon has broken down below the trend mean again in here this week. And this is an important point. I want to relate three different anecdotes that have arose that are really sticking in my mind over the course of the last 6 months. The first one was back in I think it was back in June. I was invited to a Marcus Evans conference because I am on the board of a trust company, a Nevada trust company. And there was one person there. This is basically a speed dating conference where fund managers get to pitch you their fund. There were a lot of private equity people there trying to pitch investments in their funds. And there were a lot of people there who were simply there to try and invest in their funds. I met one person in particular who really stood out in my mind. He was a long-short equity manager at PIMCO. And one of the clients had offered him $200 million to go off and start an early-stage investment fund. And he hadn't the first idea about how to value private companies. So he had come along to that conference with the express aim of trying to figure out how to start deploying that capital. And I found that to be really quite troubling because it was clear examples of money that's coming into the market when it is already very mature. Now, when we think about what is it that experienced private equity people are doing? Well, I showed this graphic quite a while ago. It was for dry powder in the private equity sector. And what we have seen over the course of the last few months has been that, or really over the last year, is that the big private equity firms like Blackstone have been raising huge quantities for their new funds, but they're not investing the money. So Blackstone has raised upwards of $20 billion for its new infrastructure or property fund, and it's just holding the money in cash. They see a market opportunity evolving where a lot of the money that has flown into these extraordinarily highly valued private companies is going to disappear. And these silly valuations that have been attached to these companies are going to get a massive haircut, that they are starting to raise capital now so that they can deploy it later. They are waiting for the big pullback. Blackstone basically bought the city of Phoenix after the housing crash. They're looking for a similar opportunity during the next recession. That's happening with the highly experienced private equity companies. Then, of course, today we have the Johnny Come Latelys, the ones that have no experience. They are plowing money into these private companies, and it's a direct response to the massive drop in yield that we've had over the course of the last decade. The Renaissance IPO ETF broke downwards in dramatic fashion this week. Now, we haven't had a pullback like this since the beginning of 2018. And what this suggests is we are very clearly at a point where there is going to be a significant drawdown. This kind of downward dynamic is a very significant trend inconsistency. It completes the top. We had the failed upside break. We had a large downside key reversal right at the peak. It came down to test the lower side of the range and test the region of the trend mean, and this week it failed. What this suggests is that the WeWork scandal is now filtering through into all of the companies that have been rushing to IPO. I've been looking back at, there was an article, and I'll see if I can find it, but there was a graphic in a Bloomberg article showing the overvaluation of the companies coming to market and whether they were profitable companies or loss-making companies by the time they came for an IPO. One thing was very clear, and it is that some of the best times to buy stocks since 2000 have been times when there were no companies that were IPOing. Well, what that tells us today is that there is a risk here for these IPO companies. There is a very volatile scenario evolving. WeWork announced in here today that they have cancelled all new leases. Well, the only way that company is going to get to be profitable is that if it continues to grow. The only way they can continue to grow is if they take on new leases. So if they've cancelled that, then there is the clear potential that this is a company that is in serious trouble. Now, when we look at the constituents of this move, we also have to consider that the biggest decliner in here today was a Chinese company. NIO produces pretty average-looking battery-powered cars. Then, when we look at the Nasdaq Golden Dragon China Index, it is down in a dynamic manner in here today. And this is also representative of a market which is under pressure. There is speculation that the Trump administration is going to limit the ability of American companies to invest in China. They don't really need a great deal of incentive to do that, considering that the QFII program was only about, or the quota was only about a third full when China removed the limits earlier in the month. But this is an index of the Chinese companies that are listed in the USA. And they had a substantial drawdown in the second half of last year. They bounced with just about everything else, but not in as dynamic a manner as everything else, and have subsequently failed to hold that move. And this looks like an environment which could potentially see us move lower. Well, I said there were three anecdotes that were worthy of consideration. I will get to the other two, but this drawdown that we're seeing in China is representative of a pronounced slowdown. When I was in China this summer, it was very clear that there is a slowdown going on there, and it is having a really quite significant knock-on effect. That's particularly true of the currency markets, where the Australian dollar has been trending downwards now for much of the last 18 months, and it has got a lot of work to do to break that downtrend. The New Zealand dollar has also been trending downwards. The Brazilian real is right in the region of its lows. The South African rand has also been weak in here, and the dollar index has pushed on to a new closing high yesterday. Now it is not, it's off the highs in here today, but it remains a reasonably bullish environment for the US dollar. Well, my daughters have developed a taste for bubble tea, and we were standing in the queue for the bubble tea about 2 weeks ago, and there were two young men, I would put them in their early 30s, sitting at the table next to us, and one was animatedly explaining that you can go to the bank and ask them for all their half dollars, and then look at those half dollars for any that were minted before 1967, and just keep those for their higher silver content. I haven't seen that kind of really enthusiastic talk about precious metals in at least a decade. And the fact that it is occurring among younger people is also something that is quite new. I was chatting with Rick Rule at a conference I was at earlier on this week, and something that he was saying was that his business is booming. They're getting inward calls regularly from 40% of the calls they're getting today are from women, which is completely different to the last bull market, and about half are from younger people, from millennials, and that is also something that is changing. So there is a different demographic now interested in the precious metal sector. Well, silver is still consolidating following that really quite extraordinary move on the upside. But it still looks like a bullish environment. We have had a very clear break in the downtrend over the course of the last 3 years, and some consolidation in the region of $20 is to be expected. When we look at the gold price, then it is still consolidating here around the $1,500 area, and it is off the lows in here today. Gold is a hedge against some of the worst proclivities of governments, and they are increasingly likely to explore some of those negative potential outcomes for the value of people's money. The Federal Reserve has found itself having to engage actively in increasing the size of its balance sheet over the course of the last 10 days. Morgan Stanley is predicting that they may have to move to a standing repo facility in the order of 500 billion. The team at Credit Suisse have been out in front of this since at least the middle of August, and they have been predicting that the Fed has got a very difficult challenge in front of them. Because of the Volcker rule, prop trading has pretty much disappeared. So there is nobody in the market today that is taking the other side of the trade. So the Federal Reserve has a reasonably easy job of maintaining the lower bound. They have more difficulty maintaining the upper bound. And it's the supply of liquidity that prop traders would have provided by buying when the yield was moving higher and selling at the lower bound that helped to contain the yield. Well, now that function is going to have to be taken over by the Federal Reserve. And the size of their balance sheet has increased by about 100 billion since the beginning of this month, and it is likely to continue to move higher. This is pretty standard stuff that the Federal Reserve, their central banking 101 is simple, that you have to keep enough liquidity in the system to ensure the smooth functioning of the financial markets and to allow for growth in the economy. They are getting a very clear message now from the market that there is not enough liquidity being made available. It suggests that we have seen the low, that we are moving into a permanently higher rate of liquidity being made available. The other point, of course, is that central banks have got a pretty dismal record of being able to withdraw liquidity once they put it in. The ECB tried to do it. They in fact did take a trillion out of circulation between 2012 and 2014. And the repercussions of that represented a deflationary spiral in Europe that required an additional 2.6 trillion to be added back in. Well, therefore, there is the real potential that it might be impossible for central banks to withdraw the liquidity because of the distorting effect that it has already had on the bond markets. If that is indeed the case, then the Federal Reserve does appear likely that they're going to have to continue to increase the size of their balance sheet in order to arrest the risks that are rising to the expansion. I personally think that if we think where are the risks, then the risks most certainly reside in China. The outlook in China is very hard to monitor because of the very overt influence that the central government has on the reporting of all statistics and on the price of everything. What we certainly know, though, is that we have asset price inflation. There are 50 million homes that are vacant, and the pork price is rising, and that is a staple in terms of the Chinese diet. That's contributing to food price inflation. What we also know is that the renminbi has fallen through 7 and looks unlikely to strengthen through 7. There is the real potential that China is moving towards a stagflationary environment. And part of the reason for that is because the central government is unwilling to supply the kind of stimulus that rescued asset prices previously. It was China's massive fiscal and monetary stimulus that rescued the global economy in 2009 and 10 and 11 and 12. At the moment, China is trying to deploy counter-cyclical strategies. That is certainly something that the USA is not trying. They do have the ability to cut rates aggressively and flood the market with liquidity. They are choosing not to because they are worried about a recession, or they're more worried about inflation. than a recession, I should say. If the recessionary risks increase, then China will have to stimulate. And that is one of the missing ingredients for a global reflation story. What we have certainly seen is that central bank largesse is starting to improve. The ECB is already engaged in quantitative easing. It has ample scope to expand that program should the need arise. What Europe lacks is a fiscal stimulus, but there are an increasingly large number of countries in Europe are moving into recession. That is an additional important point. Why is it that Europe is moving into recession today? Well, primarily it's because of falling demand for European exports in China. Then, when we think about the continuous commodity index, the index has now encountered resistance again in the region of 400. It's not down in an especially dynamic manner, but it absolutely needs to sustain a move above 400 to question the downward bias. When we look at the oil price, Brent crude was in negative territory again in here today, down about a dollar. We had the very big spike on the upside last week following the attack on Saudi production, and the price has come straight back down. It's now pretty much below where it was when the attacks were announced. I still think that there's probably room for some consolidation around the $60 area, but we're going to have to see a clear change in terms of the overall environment to really signal that there is demand here that can sustain the market. Well, what we are starting to see is that the yield curve became inverted, and what that suggests is that the clock is ticking on the next recession. The clearest risk of recession resides in China, and it then, of course, we have the knock-on effect in Europe, and monetary policy in Europe is already starting to be supportive. When we think about the bond markets, they have very swiftly priced in the potential for a recession. But what we are now starting to see is that the extraordinarily large upward dynamic that we saw on US Treasuries 3 weeks ago, well, what that suggests is that a peak of at least near-term significance has been reached, and that there is scope here for at least a reversion back to the mean. That the number one most crowded trade out there today is the clear conclusion that the USA is going to move into a zero to negative interest rate environment, that yields are going to go negative in the USA as well. And what we are starting to see now with the kind of action that we've seen in the bond markets is that there is still a fighting chance that that may be the case, but it is unlikely before we do in fact get a recession. And between now and then, there is the potential for bond yields to start to rise. One thing that we have seen is in Europe, there has been some evidence of a buyer's strike in bonds. And auctions for treasuries in the USA have been pretty tepid. So what that is beginning to suggest is that the clearest risk in the bond markets is not about whether the central bank is willing to buy the bonds of the treasury or otherwise, but rather that other investors are unwilling to do so without the clear support of the central bank. And that's an important change. And it has clearly turned the bond markets into a casino. So I think that's one of the biggest changes that we're getting right now, that there is a very big change going on in the bond markets. When I was looking at the failed upside break at the end of last year and thinking that there was a fighting chance that the yield could come all the way down to 1.5%, it was extraordinarily. I got a lot of resistance to it when I spoke at the American Association of Professional Technical Analysts in March. There was nobody believed that that was possible. Today, everyone is predicting that this trend is going to be extended in the ab, and that's against the background of this whopping upward dynamic. That rather suggests that we've had a failed break below 150, and there is the potential the yield could go all the way back up to 3%. And that's not something that people are willing to countenance at all. And that was one of the other points. Something that sounded a real note of caution for me was the conference I was at for a couple of days this week, where there were a number of notable bears who they well, in some circles, they've been considered to be the kind of people that are like a stopped clock because they're never bullish. What I had anticipated hearing from listening to people talk was that they would say that it was time to raise cash. It's time to sell everything. And I was rather surprised that what I heard most about was the wonderful potential there is for blockchain, how to invest in the cannabis sector, and that yes, there will be a recession at some stage, but that there is potential for additional upside. Now, I have been very clear in stating that this does look like a bullish consolidation on the S&P 500. And when we look at the NASDAQ 100, we have again a similar condition that we have what looks like a nice consolidation above the trend mean. When we think about the Dow Jones, it's a similar situation. We've had this consolidation in the region of the trend mean. But when we start to think then about the Russell 2000, it has failed to push back above the 1600 level. The transportation index had got right up to test its sequence of lower rally highs, and it has failed over the course of the last couple of weeks. The banking sector was in positive territory yesterday, but it wasn't, excuse me, in here today, but it was not able to hold the move, and more importantly than that, it has not been able to, as of yet at least, push up and out of this range. What I'm troubled by is the popularity of the view that this is a consolidation and that it is still time for new money. The underperformance of the IPO sector, the underperformance of cyclical sectors like the transportation index and the small caps, I find that kind of troubling. One thing that we do have to be aware of is that the pace of technological innovation is really quite impressive, but that there is a technology cycle, and then you also have the market cycle. And the market cycle is something that we need to pay particular attention to. When we think about the outlook for the wider market, then these consolidations that have been going on now for most of the last year, we do have these ranges above the trend mean. There is still potential that this that we are going to have a blow-off top, and that there is potential that the market is going to regroup. I do think that the epicenter of risk, however, is in China, that it is the slowdown in China is something we need to pay attention to. It is the recession that is growing in Europe that is also a risk. One thing that's important about the US economy is that the consumer is relatively unlevered, but the government is extraordinarily levered, and the corporate sector is extremely highly levered. The high yield sector has the scope to expand considerably if a number of investment grade companies are downgraded. But so far, despite the fact we have a sequence of higher reaction lows, there is still potential that this is not yet leading on the upside. So I think that's a meaningful point. We are still early in terms of the overall environment, or at least in the potential for a topping phase to take hold. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're not going to have a top at some point over the next 18 months. One thing that definitely happened in here this week was that the Bitcoin price broke lower, and that has been a source of really quite considerable speculation in markets. One of the animating factors behind it was the fact that Bitcoin settled futures started trading 4 days ago, and the first trades that were put on were shorts. So that is very similar to the launch of futures in the market back in December of 2017. But then, of course, there is the existential problem represented by the evolution of quantum computing, and that's an additional consideration for these markets. When we look at the wider market, then it looks like gold is something that is going to hold its value. Cryptocurrencies are going to remain volatile. Large cap equities need to demonstrate support soon if they're going to remain in a bullish environment. The contraction in the IPO index is troubling. That is feeding through into the negative performance of shares for these companies that are highly dependent on additional liquidity, and the pullback in Amazon is something that we need to pay particular attention to. And with that, I'll leave you for today. I'll wish all the best to all of you.